From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why did Nate have to die? And why did Six Feet Under have to end? On today's Fresh Air, the creator of Six Feet Under talks about bringing the series to a close. Alan Ball wrote and directed the first and last episodes of the series and oversaw the ones in between. Also, we listen back to an interview with the inventor of the Moog synthesizer. Robert Moog died Sunday at the age of 71. The instrument he created in the mid-60s caught on in the avant-garde as well as rock and pop and led the way for many of the other digital instruments that followed. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews an expanded and remixed reissue of Song X, a collaboration between Pat Metheny and Ornette Coleman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm one of the fans of HBO's 6 Feet Under who really miss the characters now that the series has ended. We invited back the creator of the series, Alan Ball, to talk with us about bringing the series to a close. He wrote and directed the final episode. He also wrote the screenplay for American Beauty. Before we go any further, a couple of disclaimers. If you're waiting to watch a tape of the final episode and don't want to know what happens, you might want to tape this interview and hold off listening until after you've watched the conclusion. And if you've never watched the show, well, I apologize if the interview is a little insy. Alan Ball has described 6 Feet Under as a show about life in the face of death and about a family who, because of their work running a funeral home, is surrounded by death. At the conclusion of the final episode, the extended family begins to emerge from their grief over Nate's death. Here they are, sitting around the table, toasting him.
I just remember, I was in seventh grade, I think. Nate was probably a junior in high school. And he had started that new wave band with Sam Hoviak and Tom Wheeler, do you remember?
I do.
And he had the worst hair. I mean, like, really big, bad 80s hair with all this spray and lacquer in it. And I was sitting next to him at dinner, and I saw something move, and it was a spider. It had spun a web in his hair.
See?
And I didn't say anything because I knew how cool he was trying to be. And I wanted him to be that cool. I wanted him to be the coolest brother anybody had ever had.
To Nate.
To Nate.
To Nate.
To Nate.
To Nate.
My firstborn.
To Uncle Nate?
Yeah. To Uncle Nate.
Can you say to Daddy?
To Daddy.
To Nate.
Alan Ball, welcome back to Fresh Air. Well, how do you feel now that it's all over?
I feel a great sense of relief. I feel like I've been through a grieving process of my own. I feel like actually making the final 4 to 5 episodes of the show was kind of like a real excursion into grief, and the final episode was sort of coming out on the other side. And looking back, I sort of realized, I guess that was my intent. My process is not quite so conscious. But I think now that's probably what the show itself was trying to do.
But to put us really all through the grieving process?
or not so much to put people through it, but to go through it itself almost. Mm-hmm, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? I mean, I'm kind of crazy. I do look at the show as a living entity that has its own will, that mm-hmm. sometimes my job is to just really get out of the way of that and not try to form it into something.
No, I kept thinking, I mean, I would really spend a lot of time coming up with alternate endings. The ending where, like, everybody's lives is totally screwed up, everybody's completely right. damaged, and then, like, the happier version. And I was wondering, like, how messy the ending was going to be and how much trouble there would be for the characters. And with the exception of Nate dying, things resolved pretty nicely. Why did you want to resolve things with reasonably happy endings for everybody?
Well, because I feel like the final stage of grief, and if anything, I've sort of looked at the show as a meditation on grief. The final stage of grief is coming out of it and sort of reconnecting with life. I don't for a minute believe that these people moved forward and their lives were without drama and without conflict and without pain and without struggle. We just didn't see that. But certainly you look at what happens and, I think David is devastated by the death of Keith. It wasn't as clear in the final montage, but Brenda had two husbands after Nate. I mean, I don't think those relationships were easy. I don't necessarily think Ruth and George lived happily ever after. And Claire, came back to her mother's funeral when she was her mid-40s and that reconnected with Ted. Who knows what happened in those years up to then. Where
oh, is that how
marriages?
They get reconnected? Okay.
Yeah.
It all goes by so quickly in the closing collage.
Right.
I could hardly keep up. Okay.
But I feel like at the moment when Claire leaves to go off to the, you know, into her new life, that's where those people are at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I never felt like, okay, everything's tied up in a nice little package.
Right.
I just felt like, well, they've started to come out of the tunnel of Nate's death, and she's leaving and something new is starting, and that's the end of this show. But
the website actually has obituaries for the main characters,
yes,
which kind of detail some of the things that happened to them later in life, in their lives past the end of the series. Can you talk a little bit about the process of sitting down alone or with the other members of the writing staff to figure out what the final fate of the characters was going to be, and to even write lives past the end of the series for them?
Well, we reconvened back in August, I guess about a year ago, to start figuring out what the final season was going to be. And within the first week, somebody had pitched, I wish I could remember, because I felt like it was such a great idea, that we actually see the deaths of all the characters. And so it just felt so organically appropriate to the show. And there was a lot of conflict in the room about whether Nate should or shouldn't die. And I was open to him not dying, but I'm very instinctive, and I just went, pitch me something that is as effective or as, you know, works as organically and fits within and is what would be the final chapter of this if it were a big, long novel. Pitch it to me. And nobody was able to. So we didn't want to kill Nate in the very last episode. We wanted to see the family deal with the grief and the loss and see how Nate's life, now that it was actually finished, at least in this plane, how it would affect those who loved him and those whom he loved.
Before Nate dies, he and his wife Brenda are fighting all the time. And then Nate starts to fall in love with Maggie, who's the daughter of his mother's estranged husband.
Right.
And he dies of this, like, brain condition that he has just after he and Maggie have sex for the mm-hmm. first and only time. Mm-hmm. Why did you and the writers want him to die at such a morally messy moment?
Well, personally, I can't speak for the other writers, but I think one of the things that appealed to us throughout the production of the show is things that were morally messy. Because to me, that seems to be so much more of what life is about than this facsimile of life that we see depicted on television, which is always about these very clear-cut moral choices and these very clearly defined heroes and villains. And this world in which people really do sort of figure things out and live these really manageable lives. Now, I don't know if I'm so far out of the mainstream that just doesn't make sense to me, or if it doesn't actually make sense to most people.
In your mind, if Nate had lived, would he and Maggie have become lovers? Would that have been the true love in his life, or do you think that would have ended too? And
in my mind, I'm not sure that had he lived, he and Brenda really would have split up.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was feeling something very deeply and passionately at that moment, and he expressed it, and then he died. And there's something really deeply tragic in that, which I'm drawn towards in terms of drama, in terms of telling a story. I mean, I think had he left Brenda and gone with Maggie, I think she would have had a real hard time living up to what he saw in her. Had he stayed with Brenda, it might have been the thing that really brought them together and they were able to move forward and actually into a new and different place. It may have just been a placeholder, and then later something else would have happened on both their parts. I mean, Brenda was in sort of a better place at the time when the series ended, but she certainly had her own streak of confusion that could have led her to different places.
My guest is Alan Ball. He's the creator of 6 Feet Under, and he wrote and directed the final episode. No, Brenda and her brother Billy are very close, but he's actually seems to be truly in love with her during part of the series, and she has to like physically rebuff him at some point. But in, I think it's like the next to the last episode, there's a sequence where they actually start to physically touch in a sexual way.
Yes.
And I was so relieved when Brenda wakes up and it's just a dream. And everyone I spoke to about that scene said exactly the same thing. I'm so glad it was just a dream. Can you talk a little bit about what went on in the writer's room about that scene and whether to do it and so on?
Well, there were actually people in the writer's room saying, Brenda and Billy just really, we just need to get them together and just let them be together. And of course, there were people in the writer's room who were pitching at the end of season four that there actually was a nuclear holocaust and that season five took place in a nuclear wasteland. So I said, no, I don't think that's going to be a satisfying experience for our audience. And I also don't think it's right for the show. Mm-hmm. These two saved each other's lives growing up with these kind of mythically horrible Greek tragedy monsters of parents that they had. And so Craig Wright, a very talented writer, was the writer who that episode was assigned to. And we knew we wanted it to go on so long that you actually got really physically uncomfortable and you thought, oh, my God, this is really happening, before she woke up from the dream. And Craig went off to write his first episode and he brought it back. And I remember I read the episode and the line where Billy goes, this is what your penis would look like if you were a boy. And I had this moment of revulsion and I thought, I'm not sure we can go there, but every other writer at that table said, we have to go there. That's what's so exciting about this moment, is because you really do see the truth of what is there on some subconscious level about their, you know, part of that weird attraction between them that was formed when they were children with these wildly sexually inappropriate parents and friends acting out all around them, is that they felt like they were each other. And I said, okay, you know, I'll trust you. I'll trust you guys on this.
My guest is Alan Ball, the creator of 6 Feet Under. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Ball, the creator of HBO's 6 Feet Under. He wrote and directed the final episode, which was shown Sunday. Have you gone to many funerals since 6 Feet Under started?
I haven't. I actually, I mean, certainly people I know have died. But because of my schedule, I haven't been able to attend, and also I avoid funerals. Funerals are very painful experiences for me, because the first funeral I ever went to was, it was for my great aunt, and my mother started weeping, and I realized I had never seen my mother cry, which says a lot about my family, which also sort of explains where the Fishers come from. And then shortly after that, it was my sister's funeral, which just was a deeply, deeply horrible, traumatic, surreal experience for me. And not long after that, my grandfather died, and there were 6 grandsons, and somebody thought it would be a really great idea for the grandsons to serve as pallbearers. And I just, I have a thing with funerals. It's a deeply, deeply painful experience for me to go. And I'm sort of ashamed to admit that I haven't been to a funeral since 6 Feet Under started.
Do you explain all this to people who expect you to come?
I don't think I've explained it to them that way. I just say I can't make it because I'm working, but you know, I'll send flowers or donations or whatever, and I certainly communicate with the survivors, but I've never been able to actually make it to the actual service. You know, each character on 6 Feet Under has a little thing about them that is just really not likable and not admirable, and I guess this is one of mine.
You know, you mentioned that the first time you saw your mother cry was at your grandparents' funeral, and is your mother And you said that's how, that's where the Fisher family comes from. Was your mother much like Ruth in any way?
In some ways. Ultimately, Ruth became her own character and her own creation. My mom is very different from her. She's got a much more wicked sense of humor. She's more earthy. She's earthier. She never was repressed in quite the same way. But certainly there are bits and pieces of my family and myself in all of these characters, as is true for all the other writers as well.
I want to clear up a plot point that confuses me and I know confuses some other people. Do you, as the creator of the series, know for sure who Maya's father is? Was it Nate?
I know for sure?
Or was it Lisa's brother-in-law? Yeah.
Who her biological father
Biological father, yes.
No, I don't. And I also don't really know what happened between Hoyt and Lisa when she died. I don't really know exactly what went on there. And that's part of what we wanted to dramatize, is what about those things that you never really know? Because I think, you know, part of what consciousness and society and certainly, you know, our modern consumer media-driven society has done is it's given us the idea that there are answers to everything and that you can know everything. And what gets ironed out by that kind of concept is mystery, you know? And I think, at the risk of sounding really stupid, you know, there is so much that we will never be able to comprehend that we don't even have the senses to comprehend. And I think part of living a spiritual life is being okay with not knowing answers that you know that you can't get. Was Maya Nate's biological daughter? We don't really know. Was she his daughter? Yes. He was her father. Ultimately, whether or not his DNA is in that child is not as important as did he love her to the best of his ability and see her as his child and make her welfare something more important than his own.
Was it hard to keep the ending a secret?
Yes.
What did you do to make sure it stayed a secret?
Well, everybody on the series was told this is really important. It's really important that this is a secret and then we keep it a secret. All of our scripts were numbered so that if somehow we could trace a script that the person would get in trouble. I don't know what kind of trouble they could actually get into. At some point, we even went as far as to leak some purposely false spoilers onto the internet. But even so, some information found its way into the internet. If you knew where to look, that people, you know, on some obscure site, which my assistant looked up, I tend to avoid those sites because they're just too confusing to me. They had it nailed that Nate dies in episode 9, that in the final episode you see everybody's death. And I sort of went, well, you know, I hope not everybody goes to that website. And fortunately, I don't think that many people do.
Very devious of you to have misled the public with false information on the internet.
Well, that's because there was some stuff getting out during season 3, and we actually went so far in season 3 as to because and we figured out that where it was coming from was when pages of the script were faxed to casting directors' offices or agents' offices, that people were getting bits and pieces and posting that on the internet. So we actually went so far as to fax false pages. We would fax the actual scenes that were being auditioned, but then in the next scene, it would say, you would see, or in the scene prior to it, on the first half of the page before the actual scene started, we would say things like, you know, Ruth collapses and is rushed to the hospital, or Ruth would turn to somebody and go, how can I be pregnant at this age or something like that? Just because you don't want it to get out there because you don't want it. I mean, certainly a big appeal, I think, of the show was that it didn't take you where you expected it to take you, hopefully, in the way that life does that. I mean, I felt like we had to be devious.
So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, interestingly, I just got back from Dartmouth college in New Hampshire, where I was doing a workshop of a new play that I've written with New York Theater Workshop. First play I've written in 10 years. And we worked on it for about a week with some great actors, a terrific director, Joe Bonney, and did a reading of it in front of an audience and went very, very well. So I'm definitely going to pursue that. I'm also in the process of adapting a novel called Towelhead by Alicia Arian, a novel that was published last year. It's a great, great story, and I want to finish the screenplay by the end of September in the hopes of directing it sometime next year. And I'm in the process of finishing up a deal with HBO to develop some new TV as
well. Oh, good.
Well.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Paul, thank you for 6 Feet Under. I'm sorry, my pleasure. It's over. I'm really glad you did it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I love talking to you. I really enjoy talking to you.
Alan Ball created the series 6 Feet Under and was its executive producer. He wrote and directed the final episode. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including Masterpieces of Western Music, Classics from the Baroque to the Modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Robert Moog, the creator of the Moog synthesizer. He died Sunday at the age of 71. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new expanded and remixed version of a 20-year-old collaboration between Pat Metheny and Ornette Coleman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Robert Moog, the creator of the first music synthesizer, died Sunday at the age of 71 of an inoperable brain tumor. Electronic music is pervasive now, but it was a new concept in the mid-60s when Moog created the Moog synthesizer. It didn't take long for other people to manufacture their own versions of the instrument. The synthesizer caught on in all forms of music, from the avant-garde to rock, pop, and novelty. This medley has just a few examples. Thank you. We heard from Sun Ra, Wendy Carlos from Switched on Bach, Todd Rundgren from a Thelonious Monk tribute album, and Stevie Wonder. Robert Moog lived in Asheville, North Carolina, where his company manufactures Moogs and theremins, the eerie-sounding instrument that has been used in many science fiction films. When I spoke with Robert Moog in 2000, he brought a mini Moog to the studio and gave a demonstration.
Okay, so here's a plain sound. This is a pure electronic pitch. And now I'll I will frequency modulate it. By that I mean that I will vary the pitch of its tone periodically. So most people would say that was a different sound than just this. Now I can speed up and slow down the modulation. Or make it a different shape. Here's what we call a square wave. It makes the tone sound like a trill. So that's just one example of how we can use one electronic circuit to periodically even aperiodically change the operation of another one and make musically interesting sounds in the process.
Now, regular instruments, acoustic instruments, operate through physically doing something to the instrument. You pound it, you press it, strum mm-hmm. it, bow it, blow air into it. Compare that with the principles of an electronic music instrument like the Moog.
The energy to make the sound is there. It comes out of the wall.
So electricity. The sound,
mm-hmm. Yes.
And so your knobs allow you to just change the shape of a sound wave.
Yes.
The amplitude, the shape of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we can increase the complexity of the sound. For instance, there's one tone. Now we can add a second tone. Here's one, the other, together. They form a richer third tone. So we can add sounds and waveforms together. We can use one waveform to shape what we hear from another circuit, and we can also filter out the overtones, the harmonics that are made by these waveforms.
You want to give me an example of that?
Here's... Let's get a brighter sound. There. This is called a low-pass filter. Originally, it was a technical term, but musicians these days, at least ones who plug in, understand what that means. So I'll close the filter, and we'll cut out first the higher overtones and then all of them. Now, when I vary the filter slowly like that, you can hear what's happening, that the sound is getting more mellow and less bright as I turn down the knob here labeled cutoff frequency. But if instead of my turning the knob, I use a waveform that goes up and then down every time I hit a key, we'll get a sound like this. That opening and closing of the filter was done not by me, but by the envelope generator. Now I'll make it faster, and you'll see what effect that has on the sound. And still faster. Now that happened so fast that if I had to do that with my hand, I couldn't possibly, because my hand can't move that fast. But electronics can move that fast. So now I have a different sort of sound. I have a plucked string-like sound. Because I've set up a sound here that's bright and with lots of harmonics at the beginning, and then within, say, 30 or 40 thousandths of a second, it dies down and our ear identifies that as a string-like sound.
Other records from the 60s when you were first, in the early 70s, when the Moog was first catching on, that you think sound almost embarrassingly dated today?
The first use of Moog synthesizer on the West Coast sounds embarrassingly dated. It's a record called Zodiac Cosmic Sound.
How can that not sound dated?
Well, what happened is this was in 1967, and we were wondering whether we could stay in business because, we weren't making any money and nobody understood our products. And we were invited to exhibit our new synthesizers out at the Audio Engineering Society in the West Coast. So at that exhibit, we were then invited to bring this one instrument that nobody had ever seen out there to a recording session of Zodiac Cosmic Sounds. And the synthesizer was used to make some distinctly novel electronic effects, one of which begins the album. But what the album is, it starts off with very conventional sounding Hollywood movie music. And then with a low organ tone, the narrator comes on. He had a voice as deep as crude oil. And he said, 9 times the color red explodes like heated blood. The battle's on. And ba 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 ba. Like that. The producers at the time were very impressed with themselves about how in this was and how hip and how many they were going to sell. Now when you play it, people just break out laughing.
So is the bum ba bums that you were doing on the synthesizer?
No. They were done more or less conventionally.
Where did the synthesizer come in?
The synthesizer came in making just drop-in sounds. Let's see if I can set one up. The Mini Moog is really not big enough to do all the sounds that we did, but let's, for instance, start with one sound. We'll add another sound. Okay, that's about a whole tone apart. I'll add a third sound. Okay. Now, that's the general sort of sound that they liked. And then we just glide up a little bit here. That sort of sound.
Great. Yeah.
Now, with the large synthesizer that we had back then at the studio in Los Angeles, you could glide more slowly, you could add more frequencies, you could make a sound that was fairly striking for those times.
We're listening back to an interview with Robert Moog. He died Sunday at the age of 71. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Till the end, until the end, until the
Robert Moog, the creator of the Moog synthesizer, died Sunday at the age of 71. We're listening back to an interview I recorded with him in 2000. What are the early records, the first records that you think really helped the Moog synthesizer catch on?
The biggie was Switched on Bach. Mm-hmm. In light of that, everything else pales. Switched on Bach came out at the end of 1968. I can remember playing a cut from it at an Audio Engineering Society convention in New York City, about a month in advance of its release. And I can remember all those cynical, experienced recording engineers listening to this and being so overjoyed that a piece of work so innovative and of such high quality was being done that they gave Carl Wallis a standing ovation.
Did you like Switched on Bach?
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, I visited Carl Wallis several times while Carl Wallis and his associates were working on the piece, and I was just bowled over every time I came. Something new was there to be heard.
Well, why don't we hear some music from Switched on Bach? And it was Walter Carlos back
yes.
then, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is Walter Carlos at the Moog synthesizer. That's Walter Carlos playing Switched on Bach, the record that helped really establish commercially the Moog synthesizer. My guest is Robert Moog, the creator of the Moog synthesizer and the related synthesizers that he's since created. He's a pioneer of electronic instruments. When you created the first Moog synthesizer, was it out of an interest in electronics or music or both?
I had been building electronic musical instruments since I was a kid. It was always a hobby of mine, and I always approached it as an electronics person, somebody who liked to work with a soldering iron and a pair of pliers, who also had some musical training. By the time I got to building synthesizers, I had perhaps 20 years experience building electronic musical instruments.
Oh, I know you built theremins, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. What else did you build?
Back in the 40s and early 50s, building simple electronic projects was a popular hobby for many people. Back then, you could buy a few parts and with tubes and build something on your kitchen table, and it would actually work. So there were magazines describing all sorts of hobby projects, and I can remember building one-note organs, two-note organs, radios, phonograph, amplifiers. And that was my life. That's what I did back then. Other kids went out and beat each other up or played baseball, and I built electronics.
I think your father was an amateur radio operator?
Yes, he was. He was a professional engineer. He worked for Consolidated Edison in New York City.
That's the electric company.
Yes, it is. He worked for them all his life, and he was also an amateur radio operator.
So this was ham radio?
Yes.
So did you think your father's ham radio stuff had an impact on you?
Why, sure. He was the one who taught me how to do electronics. He taught me how to use a soldering iron. My father had a very complete hobby basement with machine tools and all sorts of electronic stuff. I used to love to go down and just be with him and work with him.
It was a real guy thing for you?
I think so, yeah. It was a dad and son thing.
Did especially. Mom ever go down to the basement?
No. No, Mom had the rest of the house.
Now, before you started inventing your own instruments, you built theremins. So let's start with what a theremin is. You've brought one with you. I imagine this is one that you've built.
Yes, it is. Well, it's one that my company built.
Right. That's good enough.
Close enough.
Give us a taste of the basic sound of the theremin. Our listeners will recognize it from lots of science fiction movies.
Okay, let me describe what I'm doing. I'm not touching the instrument when I'm playing it now. I'm moving my hands around it to control the volume and the pitch of the sound. So I'll just make a very quick sound, and then maybe later I can actually try and play a melody. So when you wave your hands around a theremin, that's the sort of sound you get. It's not particularly musical, but it certainly sounds different from a piano or even a synthesizer. A theremin is an electronic musical instrument with two metal antennas. One is a vertical rod on the right-hand side of the instrument. The closer you get your right hand to that rod, the higher the pitch goes. So if you imagine a violin string in the air between your shoulder and the pitch antenna, and by moving my hand along that string, you can imagine the sort of gestures I make.
But it's an imaginary string.
It's an imaginary string. I'm not touching anything when I play. On the left hand of the instrument, there is a loop, a metal loop, which controls the volume. The closer I get my hand to that loop, the softer the sound gets. So my gestures consist of moving my right hand back and forth from my right shoulder to the pitch antenna to make the notes, and moving my left hand up and down as if I'm conducting an imaginary orchestra out there to control the volume and articulate the sound.
Would you play us a science fiction effect on the theremin? You could even play something from one of the movies that the theremin, one of the movies, scores that the theremin was used in.
A science fiction effect. I'll try.
And do you get that little vibrato by wiggling your hand back and forth?
Yes. I move my right hand from my wrist rapidly back and forth, just as a violinist does.
Would you like to leave us with some music on the Moog synthesizer?
Let's see. Well, that's some music. I don't know how much, but it's some.
Robert Moog, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to have the opportunity.
Robert Moog recorded in 2000. He died of a brain tumor Sunday. He was 71. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new remixed and expanded edition of a 20-year-old collaboration between Pat Metheny and Ornette Coleman. This is Fresh Air. In 1985, guitarist and Grammy magnet Pat Metheny and maverick alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman jammed for 3 weeks and then made the album Song X. They both liked the music they recorded, but afterwards Metheny had second thoughts about the material that did or didn't make it onto the album. Now he's produced an expanded and remixed version. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead liked it then and likes it now. We'll be right back.
The Good Life by Ornette Coleman, with a little help on the arrangement from Pat Metheny. Back in the 80s, a collaboration between avant-garde icon Coleman and the king of breezy fusion guitar surprised some folks. But both are lyrical players with a highly personal voice, and Ornette was already warming to the orchestral potential of electric guitar. Metheny had been all of 12 when he first heard and loved Ornette's music. Coleman's saxophone style directly influenced the guitarist's breath-like phrasing and ever-changing dynamics. Both musicians hail from the Southwest. Coleman from Fort Worth, Metheny from outside Kansas City, and both had played a lot with bassist Charlie Hayden, also from Missouri. It was Hayden's idea to bring them together in the first place. His loping time fits their big sky sense of space. A few years before, Metheny had recorded a prelude to this date, the album 8081, with the very Ornette tenor saxophonist Dewey Redmond and the ace rhythm section of Charlie Hayden and drummer Jack DeJohnette. Hayden and DeJohnette came back for Song X, alongside Ornette's drummer of choice, DeNardo Coleman, also on electronic percussion. Double drummers can make the rhythm boil, and there are a couple of extraordinarily dense episodes where saxophone and guitar synthesizer converge like a swarm of bees. Pat Metheny is known for playing accessible jazz you may hear while cruising the produce aisle or waiting on hold. But like most guitarists, he gets raunchy too, and Song X has plenty of that. Even so, the expanded 20th anniversary edition is a bit more rounded, a little less in your face than the original. Metheny's given the program a mostly improved remix, toning down some of his more extreme special effects. The bigger news is that the 2005 edition tacks 6 previously unheard pieces onto the beginning of the show, softening the overall effect without draining its vitality. The catchy tunes are mostly Ornette's, but for 2 of his added numbers, Metheny had written out chord changes for them to improvise over. Coleman's famous for avoiding fixed chord sequences, but he easily bends to them here without changing his style an iota. The original Song X proved too weird for many Pat Metheny fans, but popular taste can shift a lot in 20 years. In jazz, avant-garde practices often burrow their way into the mainstream about 2 generations later. So the timing may be right for this slightly gentler edition of Song X. There's a lot of wild playing and some very pretty tunes.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Song X 20th Anniversary, featuring Pat Metheny and Ornette Coleman. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count 2005, a state-by-state report on child well-being that looks at families overcoming barriers to work. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, the Republican senator from Mississippi, has just written a memoir called Herding Cats, A Life in Politics. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.